supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is a record year for women running for state House and Senate seats in Pennsylvania. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me to make sense of the numbers is Dr. Jenny Sweet Cushman, Assistant Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. Jenny, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start with a baseline? What's the current gender composition of the House and Senate?
Right. It's just under 19% for the entire General Assembly, a little bit higher in the House, a little bit lower in the Senate.
And what percent of voters are women?
Yeah, so that's the trick question, right? It's actually just over half. So, you know, you're talking about 53% of voters and maybe 51% of the population is female.
And it's safe to say that this is pretty much the way it's been in Pennsylvania, which to date has not had a female governor or U.S. senator. What are you seeing different this election cycle?
Right. So the number of women who are throwing their hat in the ring is up significantly over any year that certainly I've been keeping track of and to the best of my knowledge ever. So we're seeing historical numbers in both, you know, the General Assembly races and then also the congressional races across the Commonwealth.
So back to the numbers. What are you seeing this
year?
Yeah.
So we're up about 4 or 5%. Which is significant when there's been no increases year after year after year, up to about a quarter of the House seats being women, a little bit higher than that actually, and 40% of the Senate seats, so 20 of 50 are women running.
I believe to date most women in office are Republican, though this surge is being led by female Democrats.
Yeah, almost entirely. So the numbers are actually down a little bit on the Republican side, and it is, you know, as you say, being driven by Democratic women that are being, you know, pushed in and inspired to run.
What are some of the variables that you think account for the surge?
Well, obviously, women have been mobilized by a number of events, the election of Donald Trump, the Women's March, the Me Too, you know, all of the accusations in the General Assembly around sexual harassment and the reluctance to do anything about that have pushed women to think, hey, maybe the way to do something about this is for me to go there and do it. And so women who would have otherwise have, you know, waited their turn, waited to make sure that they have all of the qualifications that they think they need, said, forget that. Something has to be done, and have thrown their hats into the ring. And so increasingly you see women that maybe never really even thought of a political career saying, you know, why not me? Why don't I help be part of the change? And that's really just this very grassroots effort that women are being really at the heart of.
Is there a strategic wisdom or benefit to starting off with these state House and Senate seats rather than shooting for the governor's chair or a U.S. Senate seat?
Yeah, so the traditional path to office is what we would call a progressive ambition. So you would maybe start off on your borough council and then move up to county level. And women in particular are much more likely to want to build that resume to higher office. And so the fact that we've had so few women at each of those levels really is directly responsible for the fact that we haven't had women in Congress, we haven't had a woman governor. I think you can draw a really straight line between those things. So the fact that there are all of these women running, and there were also in the municipal races too in 2017, means that there's a farm team of women who, you know, even if they aren't successful, will have run campaigns, will know the ins and outs, and may be able to be looking for other offices in the future.
In national polls, there is such disdain now for dysfunction in government and Congress. Is that an impediment to encouraging women to seek office?
Yeah, in the past, that had kind of been the conventional wisdom was that, you know, women were kind of turned off by that. And maybe there was some truth to that in the past. But, you know, that now there's a level of frustration where I'll go be the change. If things aren't good, then maybe I can make it better. And we actually do see in political science research that, you know, women are a force for greater transparency, greater bipartisanship. greater collaboration around policy areas. And so having more women as a part of our legislature could be one way to improve upon those conditions.
Cause for optimism?
I think so.
Thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
You're welcome.
Dr. Jenny Sweet Cushman, Assistant Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. Today, jurors in Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial listen to more testimony from the other accusers who've been allowed in as witnesses. They heard from model Janice Dickinson, who claims Cosby raped her in 1982. They also heard from model Lisa Lott Lublin. Neither Dickinson nor Lublin's cases ever went to trial because the statute of limitations had expired, and now some activists are hoping to use the Cosby case to highlight their fight to end statutes of limitations on sex crimes. Such laws limit how long victims have to report rape and sexual assaults, one of the most underreported crimes. More from WHYY's Dana DeFilippo.
Some days, the soundtrack of Bill Cosby's slow walk to and from the courthouse sounds like this.
Go, Bill! Go, Bill! I'm pro Bill. Yes, lady. Go, Bill!
Other days, it's more like this.
Women's lives matter! End rape SOL!
That's protester Bird Milliken shouting, End Rape SOL. SOL stands for Statute of Limitations. Ending the statute of limitations, which basically is the time limit on how long a victim has to report a crime, has been the mission of many advocates active on sexual assault issues for years. Most states limit how long victims have to report sexual assaults, anywhere from 1 to 30 years. In Pennsylvania, adult victims have 12 years to bring a case forward.
There's no right to due process when statute of limitations limit, depending on zip code, your potential for justice.
That's Chelsea Byers. She heads the Los Angeles-based Campaign to Abolish Statutes of Limitations on Rape and Sexual Assault. Byers says there are all sorts of reasons why victims don't report sexual assaults, from feeling shame, to worrying that no one will believe them, to fearing that their attacker might take revenge. That means many of them take years to report sexual assaults. When it comes to Cosby, more than 50 women have accused him of sexual assault. Yet statutes of limitations have prevented all but Andrea Constand, the accuser at the center of this trial, from bringing their cases forward. Byers joined the protests outside Cosby's retrial this week, and Tuesday she drove to Harrisburg to deliver a petition signed by nearly 90,000 people demanding that lawmakers end Pennsylvania's statute of limitations on sexual assaults.
Pennsylvania's been home to Bill Cosby's trial. Sandusky happened in Pennsylvania. So much of the Catholic Church's crimes have come out in the state of Pennsylvania. All those things together prove that this isn't just a women's issue or a child's issue. It's everybody's issue. Men are impacted by this. And right now, silencing is happening because of the legal systems.
Byers hopes that Cosby's retrial, coupled with the context of the Me Too movement, will persuade lawmakers that now is the time for change. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
Within the artistic community, there's sometimes a divide between those who use digital technology and those who use more traditional techniques. Though a new exhibit at the University City Science Center's Art Gallery shows that there are ways for artists to merge the two approaches. For WHYY, Dana Bate reports.
The exhibit at the Esther Klein Gallery features work by three Brooklyn-based artists, all of whom use some sort of digital technology to create their art, while also manipulating the final product in some way with their own hands.
What am I looking at here?
It's a 3D printed sculpture. It's made from a 3D scan of a dancer that I worked with during a residency in Chicago.
Sophie Kahn is one of the artists whose work is featured in the exhibit. She works with 3D printers, which can't properly read the moving bodies she scans. What comes out looks like a 3D motion blur, which she then paints and buffs to look like fragmented stone. The idea is to feed a human body into the digital realm and then spit it out again into the real world. Kahn says working with digital tech allows her to create work she otherwise wouldn't be able to make.
I think there's a lot of concern in the crafts about de-skilling and, you know, that digital is taking over from traditional tools. And for me, it's actually been the opposite. Digital was my path to learning how to sculpt and how to make molds.
Artist and curator Daniel Ezzo says by using their hands and not just technology alone, the artists are able to depict the way technology and human lives have merged. She sees technology as just another tool in an artist's toolbox to convey a certain message.
I think it's a way to empower artists. At least for myself, it feels empowering just to have more tools to get closer to what my internal vision is.
For WHYY, Dana Bate.
This note, the exhibit runs through May 25th. Concussions in sports have been getting a lot of attention in recent years as evidence grew that they could cause damage that can last a lifetime. When Matt Rhoda of Lancaster County was in high school, he discovered just how frustrating recovery from a severe concussion can be. From WITF in Harrisburg, Rachel McDevitt looks at how Rhoda co-founded a startup to help athletes identify and recover from these brain injuries.
Matt Rhoda was a junior in high school when a single hockey game changed his entire life. He was skating down the ice on a breakaway when he was checked from behind and flew headfirst into the boards. Rhoda doesn't really remember the rest of that game. He knows his coach called him over to the bench and asked him, "Where are you? What year is it? And who is the president?"
I said, "You know, I'm at the Lancaster Ice Rink. It's 2014 and Barack Obama."
Rhoda was cleared to play the rest of the game, but he had sustained a severe concussion. He missed the next 2 months of school as he went in and out of doctors' offices. He suffered debilitating headaches and became depressed and anxious.
What was so frustrating about it was not knowing when I would actually be able to be my normal self again.
With his two best friends and support from his high school, Lancaster Catholic, he started researching and found a lot of concussions are missed because the testing is subjective. Dr. Michael Cordes agrees diagnosing concussions is an art, not a science. Cordes is the director of primary care sports medicine at UPMC Pinnacle, where he says they probably see between 5 and 10 concussion cases each week.
But most concussions are underreported.
He says the best way to detect a concussion is to see the injury happen. But doctors also use what's called an impact test.
Now, an impact test is a measurement of the cognitive ability, the thinking ability of an individual, combined with activity.
Athletes take the test at the beginning of a season, then again if a concussion is suspected. Cordes says he's not thrilled with the test because there are too many variables that can mess with the results. Variables like the athlete having a cold or being tired.
That was the test I did after my concussion, and it really didn't tell me anything or help at all.
This is where Rhoda says his startup Reflection can really help athletes. He and his co-founders have invented a device to create a more comprehensive picture of an athlete's brain function over the course of a season. They would take the test every week, so if a person does get a concussion, a red flag is immediately thrown up.
This one we called Minefield, where what happens is these lights appear that you have to touch.
In a basement lab on the Penn State campus, Rhoda demonstrates the latest model of the Reflection Edge. It's made of sleek touchscreen panels, only a few inches thick, 6 feet long, and a foot and a half tall. It's mounted at eye level on a tripod, a far cry from the original 70-pound version they built in high school.
It was ridiculous. It was like...
The latest version folds up like an accordion to about the size of a briefcase. The tests are like something you would see in an arcade. One's called whack-a-mole. Green squares light up at random points on the screen and slowly turn red if the athlete can't hit them fast enough.
So can I try it?
Sure. Which one did you want to try?
So there was the whack-a-mole.
I'm not an athlete, but I did give it a shot.
No.
I missed one there. That's okay.
Rhoda says they want the edge to be fun, a test athletes look forward to taking and work into their weekly routines. He says the test will help improve brain function and reaction time if done regularly, as well as detect concussions.
We envision this for more subtle cumulative effects of subconcussive blows, or just concussions that are missed because athletic trainers can't see everything at once.
Launching a business with a full course load seems like a huge challenge, but Rhoda says starting Reflection from campus has almost made it easier. As a student, he has access to grant funding, networking, and great mentors.
You know, as a 21-year-old kid, I really don't know how to run a business, but for them to be able to provide that strategic advice and answer questions I've never even thought of, that's been a huge help for us.
His company is now paying a Penn State professor to run clinical trials on the edge. Rhoda says they plan to officially launch in May and hope to have the device in 100 schools within the first year. I'm Rachel McDevitt in State College.
Fervid fans foresee no limit to the Sixers' success this season. And on the strength of a record-breaking 16-game winning streak, who can argue? Let's look to the playoffs with Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News sports columnist Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
I'm glad to be here, Dave.
Now, your fellow pundit Stephen A. Smith, his stock is up in our region. He says only the Cavaliers stand in the way of the Sixers going to the finals. We can talk about that, but first, Miami is in the way.
And Miami's a real team. Miami's a formidable team. It's more of a matchup thing than anything else. And, you know, playing at least the first game or two without Joel Embiid, it's certainly a hindrance. But they actually beat Miami without Joel Embiid in one of the two games that they beat them in the four games they play. They split the series, the season series 2-2.
And I believe the home court won out each time.
Right, right. And but the interesting thing is the matchup between Embiid and Hassan Whiteside, if it materializes, if Embiid's orbital bone, you know, heals enough to allow him to play with a mask, Embiid got into foul trouble each of the three games he played against the Heat. So that bears watching as well, you know. And once you get into the preparation for one team for 4 to 7 games, outliers, you know, statistical anomalies like that become very, very heightened and very, very important, and the other team tries to exploit them.
Everything's golden. I have yet to meet the prognosticator from before the season started who said they'd be in this position. Next year, though, there will be expectations on this team, and that'll be a whole different kind of psyche informing them.
And they embrace that. They really, if you remember at the beginning of the season, to my astonishment and to my concern, Brett Brown said, we expect to make the playoffs. And he said that was the first thing out of his mouth when he met with his team. We expect to make the playoffs.
Not hope to,
expect to. Right. And that was, of course, before they lost their number one overall pick, Markelle Fultz, for, you know, 68 games with a mysterious shoulder injury.
Also before they acquired Bellinelli and Ilyasova.
Which wouldn't have happened had they not existed and thrived without Fultz, because they had to be in position. You know, if they were significantly below 500 and didn't really have a playoff run in them, why bother? And those two players wouldn't have come here. They came here of their own free will. They had other offers. So this team craves expectations. They want to win. The most impressive thing I've seen from this team this year is that their two young stars, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, want to win more than anything. They want to be rookie. Ben wants to be rookie of the year. Joel wants to be all-defensive player. He wants to be on the all-defensive team. They want personal accolades, but they want to win more than anything. Joel Embiid didn't have to play some of the games he played, but he sort of forced them to play him. That's spectacular. That makes you a hero in Philadelphia. Ben Simmons has been an absolute warrior and a great learner and a selfless player. He's done everything he can to get them to the position of winning. Markelle Fultz was reluctant to come back, even though he was physically ready, because the team was playing so well. He didn't want to upset the chemistry because he wanted the team to win. You can't teach that.
And not so very long ago, no free agent would have considered Philadelphia. J.J. Redick broke through, and then again the aforementioned Bellinelli and Ilyasova. And now do you suspect that door will be wide open this coming offseason?
You know, I'm not sure.
Which ties into what do the Sixers need to get to the next level?
Or do they? Do they need anything to get to the next level? I mean, there's only one basketball, and there's only so many minutes. So the big name that everybody talks about is LeBron. He can opt out of his contract at the end of the season with Cleveland and plant himself in Los Angeles or New York or Philadelphia or Houston or wherever. Do you want that? I mean, I would, even though LeBron – over the next 3 to 5 years isn't going to be the LeBron of the last 3 to 5 years, obviously, because of his age. This is his 15th season. But he's become a very, very efficient player. And I don't know that having him around is a bad thing as this team becomes a team of stars or superstars. He's been a pretty good superstar. He's been hard to take sometimes, hard to digest, but he's been a very good citizen.
If the unthinkable happens and the 76ers fall to Miami in a 4-7 game series, does it diminish what they've accomplished this
Absolutely
season?
Absolutely not. I mean, anything over 40 wins from my perspective was a bonus. I would entreat people, listen, I know you think that the Sixers have a big advantage in the series, and maybe they do, but if you expect them to win, if you expect them to blow Miami out of the water and that doesn't happen, you're setting yourself up for a disappointment. If you can go into this with sort of a clear mind and no expectations, you might be – I think you'll enjoy yourself a little bit more because a lot of things can happen over 2 weeks. Temper your expectations so you can enjoy the fruits of success.
Marcus, as always, thank you for coming in to help us temper our expectations as well. Philadelphia Daily News and Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes on Newsworks tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.